Well, thank you, Veronique, and good morning to all of you, bright and early on this somewhat cooler day, actually. Thank heavens for that. It's a great pleasure to be here today. I have slightly changed my title on Veronique. I'm actually going to talk mortgage finance, but specifically on household indebtedness and mortgage stress. And for that reason, the title of this summit, Responsible Lending and Borrowing, Risk, Responsibility and Reputation, really struck a chord with me, because there's been a lot of discussion over the past few years about housing prices and increasing debt being taken on by the household sector. So I felt this was a really good opportunity to talk a little bit about these issues of debt and mortgage stress. So the Reserve Bank's interest in this area springs from two things: its responsibility for monetary policy and its mandate for financial stability. So from the perspective of monetary policy, high debt levels will influence calibration of interest rate changes. The more debt households have, the more sensitive their cash flow, and hence consumption is likely to be to a rise in interest rates. Households with higher debt levels might also sharply curtail their consumption in response to an adverse shock, such as unemployment or large falls in house prices. And this might amplify any economic downturn. But my focus today is on the potential risks to financial stability from this build-up in debt. So one of the key issues we've been focusing on is the extent to which rising household debt might presage stress in household budgets, and that might have a flow-on effect to financial stability and ultimately to the economy. Now, there's been a lot said and written about this issue in recent times. Using a multitude of data sources and anecdotes, you only have to pick up the paper to read something new about this issue every day. What I'm hoping to do today is to put all of this information into some context and to provide a balanced view of the current and prospective levels of household financial stress, and hence the implications for financial stability. So before I start, I want to make two points at the outset. The first is that there are clearly households in Australia at the moment that are experiencing financial stress. And by focusing on the financial implications for financial stability, I'm not in any way playing down the difficulties that some households are experiencing. There is a very real human cost of financial stress. The second point I wanted to make at the outset was that some of the most financially stressed households are those with lower incomes, which typically rent rather than borrow to buy a home. Access to suitable, affordable housing for this group of people is clearly a very important social issue, but given the topic of this summit and the potential link to financial stability, I'm going to focus here on household mortgage debt and the potential for financial stress arising from this. So, start off, what is financial stress? Well, the definitions of financial stress are many and varied. One definition could be where a household fails to pay its bills, or it fails to meet scheduled debt repayments on time because of a shortage of money. But this is actually quite narrow. It only captures households for which stress has already manifested itself in mispayments. A much broader definition, in fact a very broad definition if you like, might be a situation where financial pressures are causing an individual to worry about their finances, or where they can't afford things that they might normally think of as necessities. So some of these definitions might be good leading indicators of failures to meet debt repayments or defaults. So there's a role, for a variety of different indicators of financial stress. And one way that we think about it is in terms of a spectrum or a pyramid, which runs from mild stress to severe stress. So at the mild end, at the base of the pyramid, if you like, people sort of maybe feeling financially stressed, they're worrying about money, they might have to cut back on discretionary expenditure a bit, such as a holiday or their regular takeout or something like that. Slightly further up the pyramid, they might not be able to pay their bills on time, they might have to get some emergency funding from a credit card or a family member. And then right up the top of the pyramid is severe financial stress, where they can't meet their mortgage repayments, they might have to sell their home, they might face foreclosure or bankruptcy. So obviously it's wider at the bottom than it is at the top. And this reflects the fact that there will always be more households in this situation of milder stress than in the severe stress category. So for some households experiencing milder stress, their circumstances might deteriorate and they might move up the pyramid into a more severe form of financial stress. But others might be able to restrain their spending on discretionary items so they meet their essential payments and not move up further. Others might actually have a change in circumstances, a higher paying job or an inheritance or something that improves their financial position. So the idea is basically that there's a variety of different sorts of stress. Now, most people don't set out to put themselves in a position of financial stress. Some people might choose to take out a loan and put themselves at a bit of a stretch initially, perhaps even putting themselves into a bit of mild temporary stress just to make that loan. But they would typically be doing so on an expectation that it will become more manageable over time as their income rises. More serious financial stress often only comes about because of a combination of what turns out to be excessive debt and changed circumstances. So a level of mortgage debt that looked manageable when it was taken on might become unmanageable, for example, if the primary income earner of the household became unemployed, or if life circumstances changed, such as ill health or birth of a child or breakdown of a relationship. So that's sort of an idea of what financial stress might look like. What do the conditions in the housing sector over the past few years suggest about the potential for financial stress? So I think you're probably all, in this room at least, familiar with the broad story. House prices have been rising very rapidly, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. At the same time, household mortgage debt has been rising, while incomes have actually been growing relatively slowly, historically. And as a result of that, the average household mortgage debt-to-income ratio has risen from around 120% in 2012 to around 140% at the end of 2017. And that's, you can see that on the left-hand panel of that graph. The solid line is the mortgage debt-to-income ratio. The dotted line takes into account mortgage buffers, which I'll talk a little bit about in a minute. There's also another thing going on here, and there's an increasing popularity of interest-only loans over recent years. So that by the early 2017, if you just ignore the last dip, around 40% of the debt did not require principal repayments. And a particularly large share of property invested had chosen interest-only loans because of the tax incentives. Although some owner-occupier loans had also not been paying down principal, and you can also see that on this graph. Early 2017, about 60% of investor loans did not require principal repayments, and around about 20% of owner-occupier loans. So this interest-only loan situation might present a potential source of financial stress if a household circumstances were to take a negative turn. Now, this is where lending standards come in. So there's always a balance to be struck with lending standards. If they're too tight, access to credit will be unreasonably constrained, and that will potentially impact economic activity and restrict some households from making large purchases that they could afford. If they're too loose, on the other hand, borrowers and lenders could find risks building on their balance sheets, which, if they are large enough, could have implications for financial stability. Over the past few years in Australia, the regulators have been concerned that lending standards have erred on the more relaxed side. An exuberant housing market in some parts of the country and strong competition among lenders has raised the question whether financial institutions have been appropriately prudent in assessing a household's ability to meet repayments. So in response to this, there was a number of measures implemented by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority and the Australian Securities and Investments Commission to strengthen mortgage standards. And these measures have helped to improve the quality of lending over the past couple of years. But there's still a large stock of housing debt out there, some of which probably would not meet the more stringent and conservative lending standards that are currently being imposed. So how large a risk does this pose to financial stability? It depends on a number of things, including how lax the previous lending standards were, how much of the stock was lent under less prudent standards, and the repayment patterns of borrowers. Have they actually paid back principal? But one way of assessing the risk is to look to the level and trajectory of mortgage stress. So how do we measure mortgage stress? There's no single measure that captures financial stress. There are comprehensive surveys around, such as the Survey of Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia, otherwise known as HILDA, and also the Survey of Income and Housing. And these are methodologically robust, but they're actually available only with a bit of a lag. There's also a number of private sector surveys, and these are more timely, but it can be harder to assess whether their methodologies are really well focused on financial stress. And there's also information on non-performing loans, insolvencies, property repossessions. That's all fairly timely and it's reliable, but it's only an indicator of the top of the pyramid, very severe financial stress. So what I'm going to do is talk through a few measures and see what they imply about the current level of mortgage stress in Australian households. So I'm going to start with some high-level data on debt and debt servicing. As I noted earlier, the average Australian household mortgage debt-to-income ratio has been rising over recent years. And in a sense, this isn't really surprising because we've got historically low interest rates. Households have been able to service higher levels of debt. And indeed, the debt servicing ratio, which is defined as the scheduled principal interest mortgage repayments, has actually remained fairly steady at around 10% despite the rise in debt. And you can see that in that purple line there. Scheduled repayments have remained around 10%, and the interest to income has been falling. But these are all averages, so I think it's important to look at the distribution of the debt. Are the people that are holding the debt likely to be able to service it? So the HILDA survey that I mentioned earlier, it provides information on the distribution of household indebtedness and debt servicing as a share of disposable income. Now this graph looks at only owner-occupiers that have mortgage debt, unlike the other graph, which was all households, all debt, all income. So this is just owner-occupiers. And what this survey suggests, you look on the left-hand panel, is that the median debt-to-income ratio has risen steadily over the past decade, and it's around about 250% in 2016. So that's the purpley line in the middle there. It's been fairly stable. The median ratio of mortgage servicing payments, so this is sort of how much it costs to repay the debt, that ratio to income has been fairly stable through time at around 20%. And if you look on the right-hand panel, you'll see the median purple line at around about 20%. So if you actually look at the 75th percentile in mortgage payments, that's saying that 75% of households with owner-occupied debt had mortgage repayments of 30% or less of income. And that 30% or less is often used as a rough indicator of a limit for a sustainable level of mortgage repayments. So these bits of data suggest that as recently as 2016, mortgage repayments weren't at levels that would suggest an unusual or high level of financial stress for most owner-occupiers. But there is a significant minority for which mortgage stress might be an issue. There are other data sources too that suggest that the number of households experiencing mortgage stress has fallen over the past decade. The census data, for example, show that the share of indebted owner-occupiers for which actual mortgage repayments, and there I'm talking about required and voluntary repayments, the share of owner-occupier households for which actual mortgage repayments were at or above 30% of their income declined from 28% in 2011 to around 20% in 2016. And the 2015-16 Household Expenditure Survey indicates that the number of households experiencing financial stress has fallen steadily since the mid-2000s. Furthermore, a large proportion of indebted owner-occupier households are actually ahead on their mortgage repayments. Now, we've highlighted this issue in recent financial stability reviews. Total household mortgage buffers and that includes balances in offset accounts and redraw facilities, have been rising over the past few years as households have taken advantage of falling interest rates to pay down debt faster than required. And that's reflected in the left-hand panel. You can see that around about 19%, as I said, of housing loans outstanding is held in mortgage buffers, and that accounts for around 2.5 years of scheduled repayments. There is, however, some variation in the buffers, and on the right-hand panel, you'll see that around about a third of outstanding owner-occupier mortgages had at least 2 years' buffer. That's the big bar on the right-hand side. But around a quarter had less than 1 month buffer. Not all of those in that last category necessarily are vulnerable to financial stress. If, for example, they're building up other assets instead of mortgage buffers, they might still be in a position to weather changing circumstances. But nevertheless, there is a small group that there isn't much buffer. But broadly, all of this suggests that households have some protection against financial stress. There are some that are more vulnerable, as indicated by that bar at the bottom. These are probably households with lower income who can't afford prepayments, they can't afford that extra bit, or they might be those with relatively new mortgages who've yet to make many inroads to their mortgage. There's another way of measuring financial stress, and that's to ask people, survey, to self-assess. So, for example, a survey might ask about someone's ability to meet payments, the type of financial stress they've experienced, or whether they've had difficulty raising money in an emergency. And the Hilda survey, again, provides a bit of information on this. In general, measures such as these, where you ask people to self-assess, indicate that financial stress for owner-occupiers with mortgage debt hasn't really changed much over the past decade, and is probably lower than in the early 2000s. If you look at this graph, around 12% of households indicated they would expect difficulty raising funds in an emergency in 2016. That's the middle sort of light purple line. And that's declined since the early 2000s. This survey also asks people what sort of financial difficulties they had experienced over the past 12 months. So, for example, did they have difficulty paying a mortgage or bills on time? Were they unable to heat their home, or did they have to go without meals? Did they have to ask for financial assistance from a family or welfare agency? And a bit less than 20% of owner-occupiers said they'd experienced at least one difficulty in the past 12 months, which is the top bluey line. And then only 5% reported experiencing three or more of these difficulties, which is the bottom purple line. So most of these indicators also suggest that, in line with some of the other things I noted, stress has declined since 2011, which probably reflects the fall in interest rates since this time. Well, look, you've noticed I've talked about 2016 for Hilda data, so unfortunately, while the data for Hilda and the Survey on Income and Housing are very rich in terms of the information they provide, they're not very timely. So, as I said, for example, we've only just received the 2016 data. So much of the discussion on household stress that you might see in the press, for example, relies on more timely private surveys. And these surveys all measure stress in slightly different ways. Some focus specifically on mortgage stress. Others look at housing affordability, including for renters. And still others attempt to measure some measure of financial comfort more broadly than just housing. And many of these measures suggest that housing stress has been increasing over the past year or so. If we look at the history for which we have data for both the private and the comprehensive surveys I mentioned, it's actually a little difficult to reconcile their findings. There do seem to be some methodological differences that mean some surveys might overstate financial stress somewhat. For example, in some of these private surveys, self-assessed living expenses are used. And if households include discretionary expenditure that they could potentially cut back in an emergency, the amount of income available to scheduled repayments might be understated in these surveys. Furthermore, if actual mortgage repayments are used in these surveys, then those households that are routinely ahead, prepaying their mortgage, they might be assessed as having little spare income for emergencies when, in fact, they have been building up buffers and they have spare cash flow. So many of the measures I've discussed so far are more in the nature of potential financial stress. But for some households, as I mentioned, this will likely turn out to be temporary until their circumstances change. But others might find themselves in a prolonged period of belt tightening, or in the extreme, having to sell their property or default on their payments. In this latter case, financial stress will show up in non-performing loans on banks' balance sheets and perhaps even in property repossessions or bankruptcies. So what do these data tell us? Well, banks' non-performing loans have been trending upwards over the past few years, although they remain pretty low in absolute terms at around 0.8% of the bank's domestic housing loan books, as shown on this graph. And much of this rise in the last few years has been attributable to a rise in non-performing loans in the mining-exposed states of Western Australia and Queensland. And that's not unexpected given the large falls in employment and housing prices in some of these regions. Personal insolvencies, well, they've, as a share of population, have remained fairly stable over the past few years. Applications for property possession as a share of total dwelling stock has generally declined since 2010, when the GFC was on. The exception here is Western Australia, which is the green line. I think what these data indicate is that financial stress has a highly cyclical component, and there's likely to be some regions of the country that are in more difficult times than others. But the focus for financial stability considerations, is my main concern, is largely a national rather than a regional perspective. So bringing that all together, what's my overall interpretation of these myriad pieces of information? Well, I think it suggests that while debt levels are relatively high and there are owner-occupier households that are experiencing some financial stress, this group is not currently growing rapidly. This suggests that the risks to financial institutions and to financial stability more broadly from household mortgage stress are not particularly acute at the moment. Now, most of my focus so far has been on owner-occupiers, and they account for about two-thirds of the housing debt outstanding. But investment in housing has been growing strongly in recent years, as we all know. So I think it's worth briefly considering the risk of financial stress that might emanate from this group of borrowers. The risks to financial stability associated with investor mortgage debt are probably a bit different to those associated with owner-occupied debt. Investors tend to have larger deposits and hence lower starting loan-to-valuation ratios. So this graph basically shows blue is loan-to-valuation ratios greater than 90 and the purple loan-to-valuations between 80 and 90. And you can see that for owner-occupiers, they tend to have slightly higher loan-to-valuation ratios than investors, reflecting the higher deposits. The other thing with investors is that they typically have other assets. So they typically have an owner-occupier home as well, and they also earn rental income. And the other thing is that higher income taxpayers are more likely to own investment properties than those on lower incomes. So they might be better able to absorb income or interest rate shocks. But investors also have less incentive than owner-occupiers to pay down their debt. As I noted earlier, many of investors take out interest-only loans so their debt doesn't decline over time. And if housing prices were to fall substantially, those borrowers might find themselves in a position of negative equity more quickly than borrowers that had an equivalent starting loan-to-valuation ratio but had paid down principal. And indeed, what we would call the macro-financial risks are potentially heightened with investor lending. For example, since it's not their home, investors might be more inclined to sell their investment properties in an environment of falling house prices in order to minimise capital losses. And this might exacerbate the fall on house prices, and that would impact the housing wealth of all homeowners. And investors also purchase more new dwellings than owner-occupiers. So they might also exacerbate the housing construction cycle, making it prone to periods of oversupply and potentially having a knock-on effect to developers. Data from the Australian Taxation Office provides some information on housing investors. It's not particularly timely, but these data show that the share of taxpayers who are property investors has increased steadily over the past few years. In 2014-15, which is the latest data we have, around 11% of the adult population, or just over 2 million people, had at least one investment property, and around 80% of those were geared, which you can see from the right-hand panel of that graph. Most of those investors own just one investment property, but an increasing number own multiple investment properties. There's also been a marked increase in the share of geared housing investors who are over 60 years old. Now, these factors don't necessarily increase the risk of financial stress, but I think they bear watching. The recent increase in interest rates on investor loans in response to APRA's measures to reduce the growth in investor lending has probably affected the cash flows of investors. Interest rates on outstanding variable rate interest-only loans to investors have increased by about 60 basis points since 2016. However, the past few years, lenders have been assessing borrowers' ability to service the loan at a minimum interest rate of at least 7%. So while interest rates and required repayments have likely risen, many borrowers should still be relatively resilient to recent changes. Furthermore, a large proportion of interest-only loans are due to expire between 2018 and 2022. And this actually has had some press fairly recently. Some borrowers in this situation will simply move to principal and interest repayments as originally contracted in their agreements. Others may choose to extend their interest-free period, provided they meet the current lending standards, which, as I mentioned, are tighter than they used to be. But there might be some borrowers who don't meet the current more stringent lending standards, and they want to extend their interest-only repayments because they would find their step up to principal and interest repayments difficult to manage, because it is a bit of a step up. And it's this third group that might find themselves in some financial stress. So we think this is a relatively small proportion of borrowers, but it will be an area to watch as these interest-only periods start to expire. So in conclusion, I guess I would say that historically high levels of mortgage debt in Australia raises questions about the resilience of household balance sheets to a change in circumstances and the ability of the financial system to absorb a widespread increase in household financial stress. The information we have and which I've presented today, I hope shows that while there's some pockets of financial stress, the overall level of stress among mortgaged households remains relatively low. And furthermore, the banking system is strong and well capitalised, and it's supported by prudent lending standards. The risk to financial stability from this source therefore remain low, although we will clearly need to keep an eye on developments. Appropriately prudent lending standards will continue to play an important role in ensuring the financial system remains stable and that households borrow responsibly. Thank you.
Michelle. Michelle's prepared to take a few questions from the audience, and I encourage you to... Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks, Michelle. I'm Adam Mooney, the CEO of Good Shepherd Microfinance. We actually, a lot of our clients are at that base of your spectrum of those that are worrying and starting to feel financial stress, and we've reached around 250,000 people over the last little while, so with our programs. The question that I have, there's two short parts to it. One is everything the RBA is doing is really relating to financial stability. And you gave an excellent broad and narrow definition of financial stress. I'm interested in your definition of financial stability and whether it's seen by the RBA as the stability of the participants in the market, i.e. the banks and the financial service organisations, or those in whose interests, the people, the 24 million of us in Australia, in which they act, and how you see that. The second part of my question is about the short-termism of institutional investors since the global financial crisis. And quoting David Murray in a conversation I had with him in giving advice on the financial system inquiry, he observed that when he was the CEO of Commonwealth Bank, that institutional investors representing maybe 60 to 70% of the book of the share registry of Commonwealth Bank back maybe 10 years ago, comprised, had an investment horizon of around 2 to 3 years. Now it's somewhere between sort of 3 to 6 months. And so putting pressure on short-termism, and I think that's where we've got to some of this sort of, you know, you see this rising pressure cooker of, interest-only loans and so on. So how do you see that impacting the financial stability as well?
Sure. Let me see if I can remember. So the first question, it's a very good question. There are many and varied definitions of financial stability. Some focus solely on the stability of the financial system, that is, the banks. I think in Australia we think slightly broader than that. Certainly the financial system and the financial institutions are very critical. And we would all see that from the experience of the global financial crisis. If the financial institutions are not strong and well capitalised and able to bear losses, then it has a very big implication for the real economy. So I think, yes, that is absolutely central to it. I think, though, that and APRA, let me just make a point about APRA. So APRA are critically focused on that as well. The Reserve Bank thinks slightly more broadly about it. Clearly that is very important. But we are also looking at things such as, and talking about household debt, household balance sheets, things like that. So financial stability, I think we think of slightly more broadly in terms of whether or not the financial system and the interactions, what's going on in the financial system, is going to have flow-on effects to the real economy. And as I mentioned earlier, there are human costs of some of these things. So I hope that answers your question. We do think of it broadly, but we don't go down into the micro, which you clearly do. We don't go that far, but we do try to think very broadly, and I know the Governor has spoken on a number of occasions about how you balance interest rate cuts and rises versus what that might do, given that people have high debt levels and so on. So it's at the back of the Reserve Bank's mind in this case. It's broader than just simply focusing narrowly on financial institutions and does try to take into account broader economic. On the issue of institutional investors, I don't think I have many different views to David Murray, probably. I think there's a lot of work, and not just in Australia, internationally, going into culture. So I know this is an issue that APRA is focusing very heavily in on. And culture, a risk culture, it really tries to get at how the institutions think about their returns and their attitudes to risk. I think that's quite critical in this discussion, because the institutional investors, if they're pushing for high returns with short time frames, that pushes the risk culture in a particular direction. So I think it's a very important debate to have. It'll be interesting to see where this heads in the future, but it is a tension for the financial institutions, very, very much so. Probably not just financial institutions, I'd say broadly across all companies at the moment.